I'm going to begin by asking you if I have understood you correctly. When I read the thing in the New Yorker, which is the most recent thing of yours that I have read, and therefore it's the most fresh in my mind, I had the feeling that you were speaking not really about the race issue, but about the human issue, and that you were speaking for people who are able to be aware of the agony and the beauty and the terror and the nobility of humankind. Because it doesn't seem to me that you're saying that this is a race problem, because the Germans did it to the Jews, Batista did it to the Cubans, there's 3 million people who are called outcasts in Japan, no racial differentiation at all. So it seemed to me that although a great deal of what you were saying was pivoted around the race issue in this country, that is not the essence of the thing that you're conveying.
Well, I don't, in the first place, I don't believe in race. What I was trying to do was precisely to use the greatest metaphor we have in this country. I mean, the central trouble in this country. I was trying to destroy, if I can put it this way, the vocabulary in which one talks about what we call the Negro problem or the race problem. It has been used always, in my experience, to obscure a fact so simple that it's banal, that you are here beneath that sky and this earth like I am. And what your obligation is in the short time one is alive is my obligation too. And that no one, you can't and I can't, for whatever reason, make oneself less than a human being. And whoever thinks he really hates somebody else, on any level, from the most private to the most public, it's a confession you're making about yourself. When a whole population does it, it turns into a disaster like Germany. And this could happen to us.
And you are involved very deeply in trying to convey that message. I think that the next questions had best come from our director of literature and drama as to how you go about this.
Well, what I'd like most to find out is how you feel. I know you're the statement that's so widely quoted, that you want to be an honest man and a good writer. How you feel, do you feel satisfied with the kind of reaction you're getting as a writer now, not as a moralist, but when, for instance, you pick up at the issue of commentary and see that Norman Potteritz has been moved to make this kind of confession, do you feel that, you know, that you've really made contact here? Do you feel satisfied with yourself as a writer, individually?
No. It has nothing whatever to do with Norman's piece, by the way, which is a tremendous achievement, I think, not only for Norman, but for all of us. And it would be nice to think that more white people were able to say what in fact all white people know, that they are, and what we all really know, that whatever you were once afraid of, you always will be afraid of, and the part of the terror of living, and part of the triumph of it too, is learning to live with what frightens you. The American trouble is that what frightens Americans, they have never learned to live with. That's the real crisis, which we now call racial, I think. But speaking as a writer, it's impossible to, Norman, first of all, is a friend of mine. I know Norman a long time. We've talked about this for years. And I can't assume that because I wrote, that Norman, in a way, would have come to it anyway. There's something terrible about being a writer, because one would like to think that you're making an effect. But in fact, in the generality, one's got to be aware that the impact you're making, if you're making an impact, is probably very little to do with the fact that you are writing. The fact that I'm a writer is in this context, somewhat less relevant than the fact that Americans are now, for the first time, really scared about what they insist on calling their racial situation. I am not writing about the racial situation, really. Mm-hmm. But, and I'm not trying to cop out. I don't mean that, I don't mean that the way it may sound. I don't mean that I'm trying not to write about the racial situation. But I do mean that what I said before, that I'm trying to destroy the rhetoric, which in effect operates to obscure your humanity and mine.
Then do you feel that the kind of popularity that has happened, the situation that you have now of these lecture tours, the tremendous audience up at the University of California, that people have been moving toward this kind of consciousness, and you've just come to symbolize it in your writing. You don't take any personal satisfaction from having expressed it as eloquently.
Oh, I think a great deal of personal satisfaction is not quite the word. When I was writing The Fire Next Time, I was sure I'd never achieve it. And when you're working, you're always scared. And when it's over, when you realized that you've not done quite what you wanted to do, but you've done the very best you could, well, you have that. If that's satisfaction, you have that. At least you didn't cheat. It may be, on the other hand, a failure. And it will surely be, in one way or another, entirely misjudged, for good reasons or for bad. And furthermore, you who wrote it will never be able to read it. When it's over, all you can do is try to come closer to what you were after in some other piece of work.
Yeah.
So that the satisfaction you get is when it's over. And it takes about 5 minutes before that satisfaction ends.
And you get on to the next piece.
Yeah.
Did you have any other questions, John? I think you did.
I have a couple. I noticed up at the university today, you pointed out that the tactic of nonviolence appeared to have failed in Birmingham. Do you think, therefore, that these people should stop? I noticed, for instance, Jackie Robinson is now going down to Birmingham. This was on the news, and he is going to lead a demonstration, and Dick Gregory already has.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears not to have worked. It only can work when the authorities are willing to...
There is something very valuable about being a writer, in the sense that it teaches you... It's a discipline which teaches you patience. I don't mean this in any corny way. I mean that in order to do anything at all, one's got to be aware that you cannot see the effects. It is not a two and two that make four. Or it may be a two and two that make four, but you will not perhaps live to see the sum. And that is not important. I think that what is happening in Birmingham will either prove to be, when historians look back on it, the end of that endeavor called America, or the beginning of it. It had to come to this. The strategy of nonviolence was and is a strategy which is based really on the American Negro heritage. It is not a matter of Negroes having been or being capable of being passive. Mm-hmm. It's a matter, again, of knowing something about patience which most white Americans don't know. Mm-hmm. Now, insofar as that strategy can be said to have failed, one will have to revise the strategy. But from another point of view, I'm not at all certain that strategy has failed, because if it had failed, I don't think the situation in Birmingham would now be at such a terrible point. It has been pushed to that point by the energy and the passion of a handful of people in Birmingham, and all of whom knew that it had to get to this point before we could hope to get past it. So it's a question whether or not it's failed.
Oh, I would think it was a big question. Is it not apt to occur in other places?
Ah, that's not. But the question there is not whether or not it's not about nonviolence. The question there is about the rest of the republic. After all, it is not merely the Negro problem, and the country is not going, after all, to be saved by a handful of children that the country has always been very proud of, but has never taken any responsibility for. The crisis in Birmingham forces you, all of us, to be responsible for those for those children. That's what that comes to. It is really up to the Republic whether or not we fail. And this we is not a black we or a white we. We will either learn to live together here, or we will not learn to live at all.
And do you think that this can be permanently based in any effective sense on the operation of fear? Because certainly fear and power are operating very heavily in the situation now. It is a question of power, pitted against power in a way. Even nonviolence itself, as practiced in the South, is a question of tactic. It can't become a healthy outcome as long as it's at that stage.
Well, it depends on which fear you mean. What we are really living through is nothing more or less than a revolution. The people who hold the power never give it away. The power that one is trying, and I think in this, from a certain point of view, this may be happening for the first time in the history of the world, one is trying to achieve a bloodless revolution, a moral revolution. And in our situation, we have no choice. The fear that you're talking of is a white man's fear. Not only of losing his power and what he thinks of as his safety, but his very identity. And what is crucial here is that he doesn't realize that in this terrible struggle that he has waged himself to keep the Negro, as we put it quaintly, in his place, he's destroyed his own identity. Any Negro alive in this country, no matter who he is, I mean, from a narcotics addict, from the lowest of the low, even to the most hypocritical of the most hypocritical, knows more about who he is than his white counterpart does. The conditions imposed by the American Republic on the Negro have made it necessary, imperative, that he not fool himself about that. He may be destroyed by it, but it's not the same thing. I was born knowing, having to know, by the time I was 5, that life was going to be hard and that I was going to die. White Americans discover this when they're about 30 and then they go to a psychiatrist.
Do you think that the feeling that this is so is makes a man like, say, Norman Mailer jealous in some way and gives birth to this this idea of the hipster who's going to live like the Negro and is going to find out the things that he senses the Negroes know and then...
Yes, leaving Norman for the moment out of it. It's like watching people who decide that they are going to, learn how, as they put it, to swing. Oh, somebody's going to learn what you know, but he's not going to pay the dues.
Yeah.
He thinks it's on the surface. It comes from beneath. He thinks it's something he can pick up and learn and carry. It is something that you do because if you didn't, you'd be dead.
Yeah.
I was beat long before the Beat Generation ever was heard of or thought of. When I was 10 years old, we said in Harlem, when one's father came down the street, having just been fired again, when I was 10, it was 1934, he was beat to his socks. That's what beat means. Now these cats who have discovered this vocabulary 20 years later don't know what they are talking about. I was hip, long before people were hip. And that only meant that you had to take on the world and survive it. If it doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean anything. And I resent that the assumption that you can achieve an experience without undergoing it.
Yeah, what do you think of their writing, of guys like Kerouac? Does it miss the point entirely?
It's not writing. It is self-indulgence. It is masturbation. It is not writing. I hate to say that, but it is true. I mean, he's talented. Mm-hmm. So is everybody at the age of 5.
What about Mailer?
Norman is something else again. Norman is more than talented. Norman could become could have become anywhere. Fantastic writer. But I don't think he... I don't know. Norman... I hate to talk about Norman. Let me put it another way. There's a moment in any novelist's life, in any artist's life, when you've done some things and you can't do any more. And every novelist knows this is a very private thing, and there's nothing, there's no way I can translate it to you. But there's a crucial moment when you can either keep on doing what you've done, or you can make a leap which looks like death in the things you have never done before, and which you're not sure that you can do. It's an either or. If you don't try to do things that you've never done before, you can survive on your reputation for the rest of your life. But you have effectively stopped writing. And no one in the world may know it but you. But you know it. And anyone who is trying to write also knows it. And this can destroy you.
How do you feel about the critical reaction to, for instance, your last novel, Another Country? It was a good deal more restrained than it's been to the books of essays, to the Fire Next Time.
I like your use of the word restrained.
Does this really bother you? I mean, do you consider your fiction to be the real flesh of this of your work?
Yes, I'm a novelist. I think essentially it's probably much easier to read my essays. Essays are easier to read in any case. Not necessarily easier to write. I think the novel, yes, I'll confess, you know, it was my first novel in 6 years and I was very scared. And it's true, the first week of reviews, the advance reviews were ghastly, and it was very demoralizing.
Can you account for this, the kind of viciousness that came into these?
Well, I think if the novel did anything, and quite not meaning at all to discuss, not a question of whether it's a good or bad novel, because anyway, I would never know. It's the best novel I could do. But I think that it is one thing for most of my readers, let me say, you know, to deal with, it would be very hard to, for example, to attack Nobody Knows My Name. Because if you did that, then you would put yourself in the camp of the bigots and the enemy. You know, it is not fashionable to be a racist. Yeah. But on the other hand, it is not easy to be a person. And if I attack you as a liberal, let us say, on a private, personal, sexual, emotional level, then I suppose you react the way the reviewers did react, as though I committed a personal affront, as though I wrote the book only to make you angry. Mm-hmm. But I concluded finally, you know, to save my life, that I put down, there was nothing in it that I can't vouch for. And all those people in it are people we see around us every day, all of us. And if they got angry, then I suppose that I drew blood. It is one thing to treat me, you know, to feel that I'm a Negro and to deal with me that way. Mm-hmm. And quite another thing for me to become a personal threat to you. And of course, if any liberal means what he says, then he's got to move to the place where I'm a personal threat to him before he can get past it. He's got to ask himself why I'm a personal threat.
Is there a chance for a guy like Vivaldo? I mean, you leave him hanging there at the end.
That's where we all are. Yeah. They did break through to each other at least one time.
Yeah.
If you told him the truth, then he managed to hear it. And I think that was very optimistic of me.
Grim.
Very grim. Yeah.
It's not meant to be grim.
No.
My assumption is that if you can face it, then you can probably bear it. And if you can bear it, then you can change it. If you lie about it, that's the end.
But even on the basis of sensitivity, you make a certain amount of racial differentiation. Now, it's perfectly obvious that any minority which is subjected to intolerable pressure, you're going to get a high percentage of abnormal result because the pressure just simply does it. But surely, again, this also doesn't divide necessarily on racial grounds. Not all Negroes are anything, and not all white people are anything in particular, you see. If, in fact, the undue pressure and horror of what has happened to the Negro had made all of them as aware as you are, it would have indeed been a very strange result of oppression. In other words, beyond this suffering and this fear, there is this level of awareness and of compassion and so on, which it doesn't seem to me is arrived at necessarily on any given basis.
No, I'll tell you something very strange about oppression. And a very simple metaphor. If you put me in jail, you're going to have somebody watch me to keep me in jail. That means there are two prisoners. You and me. Our situation is precisely that. Oppression is banal. People do this to each other all the time. What is crucial here is that we are confronted with the results of it. Not me more than you. White people have oppressed me, yes indeed, but they destroy themselves in the act. That's the crisis. I am not the victim here. I have the advantage, after all, of having nothing whatever to lose. But no white American has that advantage. There is nothing you can do to me anymore except kill me. And for the moment, you won't have the guts to do that. But there's nothing else you can do. Now it rests with you. What do you do out of your oppression of yourself? That's the crisis.
But I'm trying to get one step beyond this in some sense of the word, and that is that supposing it's not true that I or any given person am one of the oppressors, supposing I belong to a group of people who are capable of this quintessential type of suffering and awareness. And mostly what I or this hypothetical group suffer from is an incredible sense of guilt. And guilt for something in which, in fact, we have not necessarily participated. And I do believe that there is some level at which the people in the white group who feel that way, and the people in the Negro group who understand as you understand, and whatever the groupings are, can make this cross-fertilization which may save the whole. In other words, what do I do with my guilt?
You do with your guilt what anybody who hopes to grow up does with his guilt. You recognize you'll be guilty until you drop dead. So that's classified, that's taken care of. Then what you do is operate in any, despite it. Maybe one is a worthless human being. Maybe one has committed all the crimes in the world. And at some point in anybody's life, that is certainly the way you feel. There's always a reason to be guilty. Guilt is easy. Responsibility is hard. And action is even harder. Because it does mean, for you and for me, now speaking to you as a white woman and me as a black man, that in order for us to establish this cross-fertilization, or rather to redeem this cross-fertilization, because it's already happened, you will have to give up many things and so will I. This is true of any real human connection. People modify each other. That's what's called love.
When you speak of this revolution, how do you see it happening? Do you see it happening through the confrontation when a guy like Potterhurt suddenly recognizes that he always has hated Negroes, and when other people realize this, then the possibility for the connection is made. Is this how it comes about, that you have to first recognize, really in psychoanalytical terms, just there it is, and you as a writer help bring this out, as the analyst helps bring it out, then do we try to make the love connection?
Before the psychoanalytical terms existed, the phenomenon existed. A very simple phenomenon. That whatever you were afraid of controlled you. And if you were going to conquer the fear, you had to go back to where the fear was. You couldn't deal with it in any other way. Mm-hmm. You could never get past it in any other way. If we are going to make a real connection, one's got to reduce it to one-to-one. And I know this sounds in this most popular of ages, but life is not a popularity contest or a football team. The first step is to be responsible for what you feel and what you do. And if you really are, then you can begin to realize what your responsibility is to other people. If you really are, then you have no choice but to act on it. And you are divorced in some ways, indeed, from most people, from the great mass of people. But then you are also more connected with them than ever, because even though the mass of people may not know it, they depend for their lives on what the world calls poets, which I don't mean the people who write poetry. The first responsibility is yours, and the revolution one's trying to accomplish is not... The history of revolutions is very depressing. If one looks at the history of ours, the history of the French Revolution, and one's trying to accomplish another kind of revolution, and that revolution simply involves changing a moral climate which is impossible to live. So it has to begin with a personal responsibility.
Do you think many white Americans have come to this? Would Potterhurt have? Do you think Faulkner did?
Faulkner discovered several discomforting things. He discovered that his slaves, those slaves he so adored, had in effect no descendants. Life is very rough. Life is very rough. You can't always bear what you discover. And we've got to take that into account too. Not many white Americans have come to any consciousness of themselves, no. But some have. Some do.
Do you count it in favor of the moral revolution that something like The Fire Next Time might appear in a magazine like The New Yorker?
It's a symptom of something. One's forbidden to be too optimistic. I'm very glad it appeared there. But it's one thing to be frightened by reading something, and quite another thing to be responsible for to do something. Mm-hmm. The act of reading is comparatively easy, but to assess what you have to give up, to assess what the journey will cost you, that is something else. We've sat around in this country for a long time now and talked about how things are getting better, and progress is the most... Well, progress is really an American word. It seems never to occur to Americans, but, for example, that progress can be up or down. And the question of what one's progressing toward has never seems to have entered the American mind. And Americans have bathed in self-congratulation even over such a thing as troops carrying Meredith into Mississippi. And it doesn't occur to them what a terrible thing that says about the record, the 100-year record before that, that troops now had to be used to carry one man into a university, which is presumably educating the young. No one has asked himself yet what they have been teaching in Ole Miss all these years. White people must find out what they hate when they say that they hate me. Because it isn't me.
Do you feel that there is a possibility that what you would like to achieve and what all people who understand this would like to achieve, do you feel that there's any chance that we can? For years I've been interviewing people out of the South, and for years I have marveled at the apparently quite sincere graciousness and decency of people who have been hideously treated. And I have continued to marvel at the fact that people that I would have thought would have been militant and hostile and filled with hate did not appear to be. And yet I sense a change in since the rise in popularity of the Black Muslim movement. Have, in fact, the white community waited, has it waited too long? Is there any hope in your view that it can be done on the grounds of this super structure that so few people participate in?
A bill has come in. Let me put it that way. Once I sat in a Birmingham airport waiting for my plane with a Negro porter who was saying yassam and no ma'am to everybody who happened to pass. I was the only Negro sitting there. With one side of his mouth. And on the other side of his mouth, I mean it's literally almost, he was telling me about all those people who passed. And he was a man. This is very important. There have been two standards of masculinity in this country. This is a man, no longer young, who had been all but destroyed because it is very expensive to be a man in Birmingham, Alabama, or in Brooklyn, or in Chicago, if you're black. And he hated them. And they didn't know it. Nothing has changed. All that has changed is that for the first time, the white population is confronted with the fact that Negroes have been living in another country for 400 years. And it's not because they couldn't have known it before. It's because they didn't want to know it before. That's a bill that has come in. And what happens now depends on your stamina and on my stamina. It's a fearful bill. It's a long record. We will pay it, or we won't.
I think we've been here for the time which was allotted us. We're very grateful to you for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with James Baldwin, and the novelist spoke with Elsenite Thompson and John Leonard in the Berkeley studios of Pacifica Radio. This is Pacifica, a listener-sponsored renaissance in radio, KPFK in Los Angeles.